Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
It's really nice to be back in the Zendo again. You know, yeah, there's nothing like being in the physical space. Sorry, guys. Online. But you guys know what I mean. Yeah. So you're smelling the incense. We have incense that has a scent to it. You know, it brings you right back into the room. Being present. So this talk, I kind of put together in December. It was going to be my concluding talk for when we studied verses in the faith mind. So I figured I'm going to give it tonight, you know, what the heck. It's always good to have a review. You know, when I was a school teacher, we did it all the time. We'd reintroduce something that we taught. So the thing for me is, you know, we did a lot of talking about this and what it means and all, but it's interesting that this, the title is Verses on the Faith Mind, or sometimes it's entitled Faith in Mind. And the word faith is only used two times in the whole poem, you know. So I thought I would talk about that. So we have faith in everyday language, and faith in everyday language means trust. And in Buddhism, faith means fact, you know, the fact that you are Buddha nature. But see, the way I see that is that they are the same, because what's there not to trust in Buddha nature? It's all one. There's nothing to fear. There's nothing going against you. It's all one. Unlike our discriminating mind, where one day we're up and the next day we're down, one day we're smart, the next day we're stupid, next moment we're smart, the next moment we're stupid, right? We're up and down and everywhere. And emptiness, the emptiness of Buddha nature, of course, Buddha nature includes the discriminating mind. But when I'm talking about Buddha nature, I'm really kind of talking about the aspect that is the emptiness. Emptiness, what does it do? What does it give us? Stillness. Emptiness is stillness. Emptiness is steadiness. Emptiness is balance. It's presence without thought. It's presence without judgment. It's just there. It just is, right? We tell you all the time when you're sitting in meditation, just be the breath. Open and present to it. That's a terrific, wonderful aspect of ourselves that we often don't make use of. So, you know, there are lots of metaphors for emptiness. And one that we use a lot is the ocean. Emptiness is the ocean, and we're the wave of the ocean, which is a beautiful metaphor. But I think secretly, there are many of us that don't see it that way. In fact, we see emptiness as a desert. Nothing's there. Emptiness is nothing. Nothing growing there. There's no life in a desert. But the thing is, we're so wrong, because that desert has so much potential, because when it rains, flowers bloom in the desert. Yeah, right? Those of you who know geology better than I do know that, right? Flowers bloom in a desert when it rains. So, what does it do for us? It listens without judgment. It nourishes us with time and space. It relieves suffering. And one of the most important things is that it gives us perspective. I'm going to talk about perspective in a little bit. It's the stillness in the movement. It's the emptiness in the form. We're emptiness in form, right? And it said that when Buddha entered samadhi, he entered the womb of Prajnaparamita, unparalleled, unexcelled wisdom. The womb of Prajnaparamita. When we did study the Heart Sutra, there's a reference made to that. When we go into meditation, we go into a womb. Isn't that a beautiful metaphor? We go into the womb of ourselves. We go into the womb of nourishment, stillness, quiet, just being. And it's a never-ending well. It's steadiness. It's always there. The desert that blooms listening to the cries of suffering. When you listen to yourself and you open yourself to your own cries of suffering, you open yourself to the cries of the world. So that's why we have the statue up here, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And what do we say about the Bodhisattva of compassion? He, she listens to the cries of the world. That's what we do when we meditate. We get to know ourselves. We listen to our suffering. What better thing could you do for yourself than to listen to yourself, right? That's compassion right there. That's why she's the Bodhisattva of compassion. Why? Because she listens. And somebody said that prayer is listening. And I think that meditation is listening. This is how you get to know yourself. You're not just the self that's always in a tizzy, but also the self that's the empty self, that really is your friend. That's your compassionate side. In emptiness, we untangle ourselves. We see the suffering. We see its cause, and if we're listening well enough, we can see the resolution of it. The suffering is the healing. They're not separate. Just like emptiness and form is not separate, all one. We discover ultimately that we are free, and we've always been free. Buddha nature is always there. We are free in the empty stillness of Buddha nature. And we realize that we are empty. That's the biggest perk of this whole thing, is realizing that you're empty. That all the stuff, all the rigmarole that goes around in your head, you're just jerking yourself around, as they say. And you can see it. So you don't have to have a version of perfect that the discriminating mind creates. Because emptiness doesn't judge it. Emptiness accepts everything. And in section 14 of the Faith in Mind poem, Tseng San says, one thing, all things move among and intermingle without distinction. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. To live in this faith, to live in this faith, to live in this fact is the road to non-duality, because the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. So you see, the fact and the trust, same mind, the trusting mind is the mind of Buddha nature, is the empty mind. So when you know that you are Buddha nature, there's nothing to fear. I often have fear, like in the car, going to the doctors or something like that. And I say, wait a minute, I'm Buddha nature, you know? And then I let it go because I say, I'm gonna be able to handle it. Whatever happens, whatever they say, my response is gonna come from that empty spot place, not the discriminating mind that worries and, oh, I don't want this to happen, I don't want that to happen, the preferences and the judgments and all that stuff. And then I could do it a lot easier, and my life goes a lot easier. Do I do it all the time? I would love to do it all the time, I really would, but I don't. Because, you know, when you're really training your mind to get over your discriminating mind, you know, You're trying to develop the trusting mind, the mind of oneness. Again, if you're one, you have nothing to fear. And I always say that you should really try to just do it. You know, you have a problem or an issue, something small maybe. I don't know if I should invite this person or that, but something small, you know? And you say, you know what? I'm gonna let it go. Buddha nature, I'm gonna let it go. I'm gonna see what happens. And you start small like that. So in other words, you fake it till you make it, you know? And that's what I used to do. I remember standing in the hallway, and I remember Egbert Roshi. We were standing in the hallway, and I don't remember what problem he presented in the Zendo, you know, and I was practice leader at the time. I didn't know how to answer the question. I didn't know what the solution was going to be. So I said to Egbert, I don't know, Egbert, something will come. Something will come. And he looked at me, of course something's going to come. You know, but he was thinking of it in a negative way, and I'm thinking in it of ways, I don't know, something's going to happen. It'll come. It'll present itself to me. And sure enough, it did. But you have to be open, you know, and you have to take that risk. You know, this is a risk-taking practice because, you know, there's a koan, you know, how do you jump off a 100-foot pole? You know, that's what you're doing. You're kind of taking a risk, but you don't take a big risk like, you know, on big decisions. You start with small things. And then you start to gain more confidence. It's just like when you bring Buddha nature forward and you don't get into an argument with your husband because you see it coming and you say, okay, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be open to this situation right here and now. And that moment where the argument doesn't happen, you're like, wow, that was so great. We actually communicated. Those are the moments that keep your practice going. It reinforces your practice. It sustains you, you know. But then you start to develop faith, you know, in your practice, because you're seeing yourself succeed at it. But it's kind of like, which happens, the egg or the chicken or the egg thing, right? So it's kind of a little both. So you start to have faith in something little, you know, and then faith comes back to you in other ways, you know, and then you start to develop it. And the only way you could keep doing it is by jumping off the pole. That's what we do. We start again. The Gata of Atonement, we start again. That's what we do with the Gata of Atonement. There's nothing wrong with that. Buddhism, that's what you do in Buddhism. There's no correction. That's what you do. You just start again. There's no need for recrimination. But the thing too is I wanted to mention about perspective. You know, we all need perspective. You know, that's why we talk to family and friends and we go to psychotherapists, right? But we also have perspective built in to us. That's our emptiness. That's the empty aspect of us. That's the ocean of us. That's the desert of us. You know, it's open to everything. There's a lot of potential there. If we just say, okay, I'm going to go there. I'm going to have faith in this. And then you will know for a fact that you are Buddha nature. Okay. Now, in Buddhism, there's no God. We don't talk about God. But there is recognition of, there is recognition and actualization of a source of life and a sustainer of life. You know, we acknowledge that and we call it by many different names. We say Mu, we say Buddha nature, we say true self, we say no self, we say no nature. What else do we say? That's pretty good. Buddha nature, suchness. Because we don't know what it is. This is something we cannot ever know fully. We can never understand it all. But this is fundamentally who we are. And to be whole is to know this aspect of ourselves for ourselves. That's what Buddhism pushes you to. You know, you don't take my words and use them, or Roshi's words. You go out and you find out for yourself. you know, try it. Try having faith in that empty part of yourself. And then you will know for yourself that there are moments when you can bring it forward, you know, and you can live through it. This is what makes Buddhism spiritual. You know, a lot of people come to this practice and they don't see it as a spiritual practice, and I didn't for a really long time. But you have to be able to know that you have something more here than you think you have. And in section 11, Sang San says, "For the unified mind, in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases. Doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in the true faith is possible. With a single stroke, we are freed from bondage. Nothing clings to us, and we hold to nothing. All is empty, clear, self-illuminating, with no exertion of the mind's power. Here, thought, feeling, knowledge, imagination are of no value. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other than self." I don't think I could say it any better than that. How do we cultivate this faith? Faith, as I said, you jump off the pole, you take a risk. But you visit yourself often in zazen. That's why we sit zazen, to connect with the emptiness that's within. Now we connect with the listener. We connect with the perspective. We connect with the balance, the steadiness. Then we could bring up a koan. Then we could bring up a problem in our lives. Once we make the connection, we can cultivate this faith in daily life through our mindfulness practices, which I talk about all the time. You know, being totally present while you're cooking, just being totally present, you become the cooking. Not judging the cooking, not wondering about the cooking, not imagining what people are going to say about the cooking, just the cooking. Of course, accepting things as we are and letting go of preferences, that was big emphasis in the poem. But I also say choosing oneness over duality. Those are those moments when you recognize you're in the middle of something, you know, and you know it could go one way or the other, and you choose for oneness. You choose, okay, I'm wrong again. You know, and you say, okay, I'm wrong again. It's hard to have faith, you know, in something that you can never fully understand or that you think is a desert. But it comes down to how is it you want to live. So, do you want to live with one eye open and one eye closed? Or do you want to live with two eyes functioning as one? And that is the eye that never sleeps that they talk about in the poem. And it's a choice. We always make a choice of how we want to live our lives. So I'll leave you just with one thing. There was a mantra that I used to say. It's a Christian mantra. I don't even know where I got it from. But you probably have heard it. It's be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am God. I used to say it backwards and forwards. God am, I am God, that kind of thing. Of course, I don't do it now. But, you know, it came to me because I thought, this is what we do in meditation. We sit. We're still. And the whole idea is to realize the wholeness of who we are, to realize that we are more than we think we are, to realize we're the whole universe. You know, hard. You understand it with your brain. You have to experience it. You have to feel it. Just right now. That's it. Right there. Thank you.